and so forth. You know, some critical mind was completely wrong. He actually knew what we were thinking rather than what we were just saying. So that's sort of one of my first memories of Lama. Lama became my main teacher, in Tibetan Buddhism we say my root guru. And I felt very guided by him over the years. I remember once, I've got 1 minute left here, I'll tell you one more anecdote. Lama was sending me to Manjushri Institute in England. This is about 1976, I can't remember, maybe 77. And before I left, I came up to his room in the Gompa. I made three prostrations and I took my, you know, as we do in Tibetan Buddhism. And I said, Lama, do you have any last advice for me before I go? Because we were about to begin what was going to be the Geshe program, which was never the Gelugpa Society. The Lamas had said that if they had promised Lama Geshe that if it was taught by a respected Geshe in English, we would be able to get the Geshe degrees. Later, they reneged on that. So we don't have any Geshe program any longer. But anyway, that was what we were going for. And I asked Lama, was there any advice? And Lama said, sort of looked up, thought for a minute, and said, intellectual Mount Meru isn't worth kaka. You know, like kids, you know, Tibetan, you know, like we say in English, kids say kaka, right, for excrement. So, you know, he said, the most important thing is that whatever you learn, that it be to the aim of your spiritual development, not just your intellectual knowledge and so forth, that you should put things into practice and so forth. So, okay. So that's just a little couple of, I don't know, stories. So in case we get disconnected again, we were just disconnected a couple of minutes ago, seemingly out of thin air. It said that we had been disconnected. So if we do, wait 10 seconds and try to connect again. Maybe there's something going on with the computers or something. So good morning. We're going to begin with a little meditation, as we've done before. So sit comfortably. Put your back straight if you can. Relax your body, relax your mind, in the sense that you don't have to think about anything in the future or the past. Remind yourself, I'm just going to be present now. Watch your respiration with your mind. When you're breathing in, when you're breathing out, be aware of the difference between the two. Once you have recognized that, try to keep it in mind. Develop the mental factor we call mindfulness. Just watching the breathing to the exclusion of all other thoughts. You don't need to control the breathing. Like right now, see if you can perceive your heartbeat with your mind, not with your hand or anything like that. Most people are not able to control their heartbeat, so that's a good test case here. You're just watching it. In the same way, just watch your breathing. let other thoughts disappear because you're not paying attention to them, which gives a really good insight into our mind. Thoughts have longevity, emotions have longevity, and so forth, if you feed them with your attention. If you let them go, don't pay attention to them, they become less prominent, they come less frequently. If your mind has become a little bit calm as of this exercise, mental exercise, now bring your attention to your mind itself, your mental consciousness, not your eyes, not your eye consciousness. You can sort of check that off. Maybe pay attention to your eyes for a second and say, not this, not my ear consciousness, not my nose, tongue, or body consciousness. Just that entity within which you think, you remember, you plan, you make observations, notice the thoughts as though they were clouds. They are clouds in your otherwise clear sky of your mind, space-like. Recognizing the thoughts as appearing within the space of your mind, you can pay attention to this space-like nature, the clear-like nature of the mind, rather than the thoughts themselves. Again, thereby depriving the thoughts of their longevity as you take your attention away from them and focus on the nature of the mind, its lack of any obstructing contact to the thoughts, as opposed to the material of the thoughts themselves. Even if you have a pain in the body, recognize that as being experienced by your mental consciousness as some kind of sort of an appearance to the mind. And ask yourself to turn your attention away from the objective thoughts, in this case, the appearance of pain, to the mind, the nature of the mind within which that's arising. The perceiver rather than the perceived thought. As you don't pay attention as much to the thought, let's say the appearance of the pain, the body has a chance to relax, and sometimes the pain can begin to subside a little, even when it appears to your mind again. This clear light nature of the mind is what we call the conventional nature of the mind, not the emptiness of the mind, just the conventional clear light nature of the mind. It's also called the developmental Buddha nature. It signals to us as we begin to recognize it that we can develop any thought that we have, especially virtuous thoughts that we have yet to develop in the past. We can eliminate from the mind any faulty states of mind, anger, attachment, ignorance, jealousy, pride, low self-esteem, depression. This is what we have all the time as a human being. Even animals have it. Spirits, hell beings have it, but they don't have any opportunity to recognize it as we do right now. They haven't been instructed. They don't have the intelligence to do it. But we have, as a result of our past actions, our past karma, previous lives, we have a life as a human right now. Not just the general human life, but one of what the Buddha called one of leisure and endowment. Freedom, leisure, same word, different translation, endowment or richness. We're free of states in which we wouldn't be able to meditate. We're not born as an animal or a hell being or a long life god. We have everything that we need to practice the Dharma. You don't need to make more money to practice the Dharma. You don't need to have a condominium to practice Dharma. This life can be used in many ways. We can try to bring about pleasure for the present, following what the Buddha called the eight worldly concerns or the eight worldly dharmas, desiring for more happiness, possessions, power, fame, and so forth. But all of those are transitory. Maybe many of us have turned to a spiritual path, especially Buddhism, out of a frustration with the constant seeking for some kind of instant gratification. What we can develop with this life of leisure and endowment that's much more worthwhile is realizations to make us a better person, to bring us calm and happiness, to become a less adversarial or irritating person. We can overcome our anger, our attachment, so that we no longer harm others. But beyond that, we can actually benefit others, not simply in the present with our friendship or worldly advice or generosity and so forth, but we can benefit others by ourselves elevating our spiritual level and leading others into that same realm. Ideally, with respect to all living beings who've been infinitely kind to us in other lives, as our mother, who raised us, gave us the body, protected us from walking into the street, sticking our finger in the electric socket, falling into the swimming pool, who educated us, who gave us food and nutrient and all pleasures, even as we grow older, wanting us to be happy. All these living beings are stuck in cyclic existence. All our mothers, our past mothers, mother sentient beings. And out of a sense of responsibility for them, now that we have a life of leisured endowment and realize what we can do with it, we can aim to achieve enlightenment, a state that's gone beyond all faults of the mind, developed infinitely all the qualities, that knows precisely all of the thoughts of others, their interests, their abilities, their karmic instincts, and knows through experience all of the paths that can lead beings out of cyclic existence into liberation and enlightenment. With a wish to achieve that state out of compassion for other beings who are exactly equal with us and wanting to be happy and be free of suffering. This state of mind is what the Buddha referred to as bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, the mind that wishing enlightenment, aiming for that, but not just for our own sake, but for the sake of developing the ability to effortlessly, spontaneously, and without error, lead others into happiness. Even now we give advice to friends, but our advice is not based on omniscience, not based on knowing what the results will actually be. Sometimes we're helpful, sometimes we're not. In order to achieve enlightenment, we need to know the mind. We need to know how to meditate. We need to know the Buddhist teachings, which we're going to talk about this morning. So try to set a motivation. I'm going to participate this morning in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. The material that I learn, that I think about, meditate on, not just intellectual knowledge, but to use to become a better person for the sake of all sentient beings. I'm going to listen to the teachings in order to become a Buddha for the sake of all living beings. So then bring your attention back to the present. That's setting a motivation. And the Buddha taught that when we create actions, the most important factor is our state of mind, our motivation. There are two kinds of motivation. Motivation that comes before an action, why you enter into it, and the motivation that's simultaneous with your action. So having created, hopefully, a virtuous motivation at the beginning, you know, I'm going to listen to this, participate, think about it, you know, weigh what's being said and so forth. for the benefit of sentient beings, that motivation sort of colors everything that comes afterwards. Even if you forget that motivation in the meantime, it creates a situation in which all of the actions, until that action that you engaged in, say, listening to the teaching, until that's finished, all of that is colored by original motivation and takes on a virtuous quality because of that. So, anyone have any question? We talked last week a little bit about funny title, How to Be Happy in Samsara. Generally, you would say, it's not possible to be happy in samsara. It's the nature of suffering. But you can develop Dharma happiness. You can develop eventually uncontaminated happiness. It's said that the bodhisattvas, once you have developed bodhicitta and you're engaging in the path, go from joy to joy. You know, they become more and more blissful and so forth. It's not as though they are from the very start out of some cyclic existence. They still have physical suffering, but their minds, their mental consciousness, whatever happens outside can remain blissful, happy. So any questions? Any thoughts? I notice we're not getting a Zoom feed from a video from the Kadampa Gompa. Maybe they need to conserve their bandwidth data, you think? Maybe they turned off. Okay. So anyone have question? No questions? Doubts? It doesn't have to be about the material we talked about last week. Oh, there's Don Brown also. Okay, interesting. Okay, no questions. Good. Oh, there's the Gompa again. I think I've told this story several times in different courses. Sometimes people are shy to ask questions. You shouldn't feel that way. When I was teaching in Japan one time, I asked people if they had questions. And I don't know if you know, Japanese culture is one saving face, you know, being very reserved. So people didn't generally ask questions. At the end of the course, I think it was a weekend seminar in Tokyo, the students came to me and said, oh, Bante, which is how often they refer to their teachers, you know, Bante, we would like to have a party afterwards, you know, for the weekend seminar. I said, okay, that's okay. I said, but Bante, we'd like to have sake at the party. And I wasn't sure sake is, maybe you know, is alcoholic beverage. And I said, well, generally, you know, Buddhism, you know, one of our precepts, the most important precept, is not to take intoxicants. But they say, but Bante, we always have sake at these parties. And so trying to fit in somehow, not to be intolerant, I said, okay, once they're having food, it's being passed around, they're having a little sake. And then when I asked if there were any questions, there were so many questions. I think because their inhibitions had been sort of leveled out. If you ever go to a cocktail party, you may recognize that phenomena. You feel you say things that you might not say when your mind is more guarded. And so when people have hesitancy to ask questions, I say, pass the sake. You know, metaphorically, you know, just, you know, let go of your inhibitions if you'd like to ask something. Okay, enough said. So last week we talked a bit about antidotes to anger. Remember, the idea being that if you want to be happy in samsara, anger, attachment, and so forth are states of mind that bring about unpleasant ambiance, unpleasantness immediately, and they create karma. Their actions, the Indian word, the Sanskrit word karma means action, right? So they create actions. Those actions leave an imprint in our mind stream, say karmic seeds, which will also bring about suffering in future lives. So if we want to have a better time in samsara, maybe try to be happy, have dharma happiness and so forth, one of the essential ingredients is to eliminate the delusions from our mind. In order to eliminate them, we need to find methods that cause those negative states of mind to be removed, to overcome them. Like when you're angry, if someone says, or if you say to yourself, don't be angry, maybe that's not enough. Does that work for you? If you're angry and you just tell yourself, don't be angry, or someone else tells you, don't be angry, you don't have a way to control the mind. The anger comes there. So we need to find some antidotes. And we talked about these four methods of the Kadampa Geshes last week, that all Kadampa, all Kadampa students should know, because your forefathers or foremothers, your ancestor, Kadampa ancestors, this was their heritage they're passing on to you. So it's good to know. So I mentioned today, we're talking a little bit about some antidotes to attachment. Someone said, sure. What is someone saying? I couldn't hear. Someone said something. Now, how many people here think, oh, Don Brown, what were you saying?
Could you review the four antidotes to anger from last week for those of us that were not?
Yeah, those of us who were sleeping. So
here's a good thing.
Yeah. So for instance, the first one is I think the Kadampa Geshes called it, in Tibetan, translated in English, it would be something like the arrow in the target. So right now, if you experience something that's unpleasant as a result of your past karma, you know, you feel suffering because of your past karma, it's a case of having created a karma in the past that has now ripened. And the ripening is not due simply to the outside situation, such as the other person saying bad words to you or hitting you in the face or stealing your money or something like that. The main cause of your unhappiness is the karma that you created in the past. Like having shot an arrow, it won't hit the target if there's, there won't be an arrow hitting a target unless you shot an arrow. Unless you've created the karma in the past, there's no way, even you encounter unpleasant situations, if you haven't created the karma to feel suffering, you won't experience any suffering. So the first of the Kadampa methods to overcome anger is essentially meditation on karma. So rather than thinking the other person is the cause of my suffering, they're to blame, taking responsibility. So a little bit of mental jujitsu, sort of, instead of grappling with the outer problem, turning your attention to yourself, putting the responsibility on yourself. Like in our in our meditation at the beginning, rather than looking at the objective thoughts in your mind, paying attention to them, turning your attention to the subjective mind, a little bit similar to jujitsu. But here, rather than exacerbating, making worse your projection that the other is the cause of your suffering, putting the responsibility on yourself. So then already the anger can begin to subside a little bit. Excuse me. The anger can begin to subside because you're not continually thinking the other person is the object and therefore using that as an excuse to get angry. A second method, another method is a method of compassion. Rather than thinking the other person is, worthy of being harmed, worthy of my anger. They need that. I mentioned last week, sometimes when we get angry and other people are aghast, if we say something very snappish towards someone else and other people say, why did you say that? And we say, they needed that. We rationalize in our mind as though the other person is worthy of being scorned or hurt or, beaten or, put down and somehow. With compassion, this mental jujitsu, you turn away from believing that false narrative, what we call inappropriate attention, the thought that thinks others are worthy to be harmed, and recognizing they, like ourselves, they are worthy to be taken care of. They are like us, they want to be happy. How would we feel if we were abused in the same way that we're abusing others? So with a mind of compassion that wishes them to be free of suffering, holding back our abuse and our harm and so forth. So that's very skillful. That is an antidote that can help in some cases of your anger. You can apply all of these antidotes one at a time. Maybe one or more will be more prominent. Another antidote is the antidote of wisdom. Mainly, we talked last week about the wisdom of impermanence. So anger can sometimes be fueled by our intolerance. I can't stand this any longer. It's like it's never going to end. Just recognizing that the situation is changing. Our attitude is changing. The other person is changing. Rather than holding on anger for a long time, recognizing this too will pass. I gave the story of my friend in Lebanon who'd been put in prison and abused. But his mind was somewhat subdued because when I went to see him, he said, this too will pass. We had read in the Sufi literature that sort of aphorism that you find in a lot of spiritual traditions. You can also talk about the wisdom of selflessness, the wisdom of emptiness. The third one here has two aspects, conventional wisdom, which means the wisdom of impermanence, but also the wisdom of emptiness. If you recognize there's no real self, the way that we're imagining that is being harmed, there's no real I, there's no real inherently existent, unbearable situation that is fueling your anger, that can help to subdue it. So arrow in the target, we're talking about karma, compassion, wisdom, two kinds, and then guru. Recognizing the situation as actually beneficial for your spiritual situation. It's teaching you. It's like a wrathful guru. You know, reminding you to practice patience, reminding you the nature of cyclic existence is suffering. You know, so often, just that itself, recognizing, as the Buddha said, that all of cyclic existence is the nature of suffering. We have our samsaric happiness, of course, but it's never real happiness. It's just exchanging one suffering for another. You know, you're drinking Coca-Cola when you're thirsty until you become, your stomach is full of Coca-Cola and you begin to, no longer want Coca-Cola, or overdosing on what? Doritos, peanut butter, you know, something, so that at a certain point you, stop, I don't want any more. You recognize that just coming in contact with things isn't the nature of happiness. Certain things that are pleasant at a certain point, they always turn into suffering. So recognizing the situation as your guru, you overcome the thought that thinks, I don't need this. I don't need this suffering. As I mentioned, I remember reading and listening when I came back to the States many years ago, and sort of, I don't know, the Friends, the TV series Friends or something like that. There was this expression that people made, when you're a friend or someone is abusing you in some way and you're frustrated, you say, I don't need this, you know, turning away and walking away. Like, I don't need this. Here you think, I need this. This is my guru. So these are called the four Kadampa Geshe methods to generate antidotes to anger. There are many other things too. So I mentioned last week, Don, you can put down your nice hand now, unless you have some other comment. There you go. I mentioned that we were talking a little bit about attachment, antidotes to attachment. So what I wanted to ask was, how many people here recognize anger as a problem? Is there anyone, well, let me ask it this way. Is anyone think anger is good? Put up your hand. I have to look at the other window here to see if there's anyone in the other window. Anyone putting their hand out? No one voting for anger. Is it something good? We generally recognize anger as detrimental. Sometimes courts mandate anger management course or something, you know, to people that have a problem with anger. There are some people who think anger is good because it protects them, you know, keeps others away, you know, wrathfulness, you know, if you have a problem. But generally, we recognize it as bad. What about attachment? Is attachment have the same detrimental effect? Is it as much a problem as anger? Let's see. I see Jane is kind of nodding. What do you think, Jane? Jane Austen.
I don't, it's something that I work on in myself, not to be attached to outcomes, to be present, to be mindful, to be compassionate, and then release, not be attached to.
What was that? Release, did you say?
To not be attached to the outcomes of.
Right. Well, let's say even outcomes. So let's say even attached to our friends, oftentimes people think of that as a virtue. You know, if you don't have, how can you love without attachment? You think, can you love without attachment?
Well, I don't know that I personally can at this point, but that I do. I may be wrong on this, but I think that that's a journey in this human life to be present and loving in the moment, but not to be attached.
Right.
I mean, that's my understanding at this point in my studies.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So oftentimes some people think that you can't love without attachment. Some people might think that. But from a Buddhist perspective, I think even from Christian real love is one in which attachment is diminished. What is attachment? Attachment is a mental state in which you experience something that's pleasant, and as a result of thinking about it in the wrong way, thinking, oh, this is real happiness. This will last forever. Maybe at the beginning of relationships, this will last forever. This is something I need. This is something I can't do without. The mind thinking in that way exaggerates the qualities of either the happiness itself or the object of the happiness, say the other person, or just the happy state, exaggerates the qualities of that and wants to keep it. That's so attached. You're attached to it. Like I say, when we say, when someone has fallen in love, you know that expression, fall in love? It's as though if you were to take away the object of your love, so the attachment, when we say falling in love, I think that's the kind of love that's not a real love. That's completely contaminated with attachment. If you have that kind of state of mind, if the other person were to leave or your relationship would be imperiled in some way, you'd say, my heart is broken. You know that expression? What does that mean? My heart is broken. David Strabel, do you have a thought? Yeah, okay.
I'm trying to.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
I have the microphone turned on. Certainly, I think feeling that the heart is broken is a very painful thing. And I suppose it, as you consider it, you begin to realize that you were attached and that you had unrealistic expectations, but can be very hard to live through.
Right. Yeah. So that's one of the obvious shortcomings of attachment. Sometimes people would not have any insight at all into that it was a result of attachment. Someone had had their hand up a moment ago, and I had asked David the question first before I noticed him. Oh, Mike. So, Mike, what were you going to add?
Yeah, that is romantic love, which seems to be, when it falls apart, just profound sadness. And it is kind of like that attachment of being wrapped up in yourself, very much the I love me kind of.
Right. That's the most important part of this.
Your being that you care about. It's an animal too. But among the poisons, it seems that, everything is kind of goes back to the ignorance and failure to see things as the Dharma teaches.
Right.
And yet, anger is the worst. I think anger is like the most dangerous and the most harmful. Correct me, please, if I'm wrong. And attachment, I think, is strongest and most dangerous at the point of death.
So you said dangerous for both, but yeah.
Yeah,
so,
but when you're dying, I think is the most difficult and pesky pesky thing to deal with.
Right, of course. We're attached to this life. We're attached to a longevity and so forth. So this is an interesting question, the difference between anger and attachment. Anger, it creates of the most powerful delusions. Anger is that which brings about the greatest immediate suffering. But attachment, because of the fact that the object that we're attached to is something that's pleasant, we don't recognize the detriments of attachment right away. It's something that we only recognize when the object of attachment is not gained, or once we've had the experience of the object of attachment, when it's left, when impermanence takes place and, you know, we no longer have that connection. Generally in the Hinayana tradition, let's say the Theravada or so forth, the main obstacle to overcome is attachment, because they want to, as you mentioned, at the time of death, attachment is what propels us into the future life. Attachment is what, at the time of death, is what ripens our karmic seeds that lead to rebirth. So in order to achieve, from a Hinayana point of view, in order to achieve nirvana or liberation, one has to overcome that that kind of attachment we call craving. In the 12 links of dependent origination, we call craving, grasping, and becoming. Craving and grasping are very strong forms of attachment that at the time of death ripen our seeds. So in the Hinayana tradition, it's very austere, right? The monastics never, you know, even on the bus, say in Thailand, where was our one student? I think there's one lady here. Oh yeah, Hien, are you Vietnamese or Thai or what?
I am from Vietnam. I'm Vietnamese. Yeah.
So on the bus, did you live in Vietnam or were you born here?
No, I left Vietnam when I was 17 years old. Yeah, so okay. I was born in Vietnam.
Do you remember on the buses in Vietnam that the monks had a separate place if they were to come on the bus, where they would not sit with the lay women, for instance? Do you remember that, or maybe not?
I don't know about that.
Okay, so yes. Say in Thailand, other countries, the monks would have a separate place to sit, because the idea meaning that if they were to rub shoulders with a woman or come in contact with a woman, they could break their vows. Very, very ascetic kind of practice, you know, to avoid attachment rising, keeping their vows for that reason, not having, you know, relationships and so forth. Whereas because of the fact that attachment has this effect of elongating samsara, in the Mahayana, the greater evil, you might say, is anger, because the driving force of the Mahayana is compassion for others, which is the antithesis of, you know, violence and, you know, harmfulness and so forth. You know what was Gandhi's famous slogan? You know, in Indian, what they say? Ahimsa, nonviolence. Martin Luther King also, an adherence of nonviolence. So that's more of from the Mahayana point of view, the major obstacle to the spiritual path at the beginning. Both of them have to be overcome, anger and attachment. But attachment, the difficulty with attachment is because of the object of attachment is something pleasant. We don't recognize attachment as being harmful at the beginning. Don, you have an observation.
One is You know, Venerable Ravina has been here many times, and she often says, anger is what happens when attachment does not get what it wants.
It's sometimes the case, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's one question. And the other one is, what is it about...
It's not always the case, but anyway, yeah, go on.
What is it about attachment that causes us to exaggerate the positive qualities of its object? And then, of course, that leads to the clinging and the grasping and all of that.
Right. So it's not something that's inherent to attachment alone. All of the delusions arise because of some experience and wrong thinking about the experience, what we call inappropriate attention. You know, like attachment thinking, oh, that girl looks sweet. She looks kind of intelligent. Maybe we'd get along, you know, thinking like this. If we got together, maybe we could form a team. We could, and so forth and so on. When you see someone attractive, you know, for a woman, maybe seeing a handsome man or so forth, or you seeing, a car that you like or food that you like, you get attached to food, don't you? You get attached to pleasure and so forth. So the driving force of attachment is that you experience something that's pleasant. That's no problem. From a Buddhist point of view, it's okay to feel happiness and joy. After all, it's samsaric happiness. It's not going to last. It's going to eventually change into suffering, but it's okay to experience happiness. It's okay to have good food and friends and so forth. The problem is when the mind begins to think wrongly about that. Inappropriate attention. So what does inappropriate attention mean? Inappropriate attention means rather than thinking that, you know, in these ways that are, almost thinking this would be real happiness. There's no real happiness in samsaric events. The real happiness that Buddhism talks about is uncontaminated happiness or something approximating uncontaminated happiness, where you no longer have ego grasping, something approximating that we'd call Dharma happiness, where the delusions are subdued, the mind remains clear and calm and so forth, thinking this would be real happiness. This will, if I get this, I'll have it for a long time. You don't know. It's impermanent. You know, it's up to karma. That this is something that's pure, the mind thinking that way. Not recognizing, some people, when you enter into a relationship, you find something attractive about the other person that's so blazing that the defects of the other person are like the stars in the daylight. Can you see the stars in the daylight? Anyone?
No.
No, right? Julie, do anything. Can you see stars in the daylight while the sun is out? Julie Lewis? No, you can't. Okay, good. You don't have to unmute. You can just say. So, you've seen eclipses. I remember here in my house in Green Mountain, it was north of Asheville. There was an eclipse a couple of years ago. So I sat on my lawn chair and watched the sky, and I could see the stars. It was a couple of years ago. There was a pretty, if it wasn't a full eclipse, it was pretty full. You could see the stars. When the brightness of the sun goes down, you can see the stars. But when attachment, when you're just looking at some quality, you're so transfixed with some quality of something, all of the faults that might otherwise be obvious to other people, of your loved one, they become like the stars during the daylight. You don't see them. It's only when you come, when some kind of situation comes later that you start to feel irritation about the other person, about their faults. So wrong thinking here, the wrong way of thinking, inappropriate attention of the object of attachment is thinking. That's really, that's pure. That's just all good. Not recognizing that there are parts. The person has personality elements, you know, besides the attractiveness of their body or the certain intellectual qualities that, that might be admirable, their intelligence or their kindness, but they also have other parts of their mind, their delusions. And when they arise, we sometimes find in, what is it called, irreconcilable differences, which is the legal term when they talk about divorcing. We're divorcing for, not because they beat you or something, because we have irreconcilable differences. It means like you started to recognize, you know, with appropriate attention, you started to notice that they have faults that you can't live with. Generally, to overcome attachment to the body for the monastics, say that the Buddha mainly was teaching monks at the time. At the beginning, there were no nuns in the Buddhist order. It was only later when the Buddha was petitioned by his former wife and his former, or his stepmother who raised him when his mother died at youth. They only later that he allowed women into the monastic order. But and I've lost my train of thought when I was beginning to mention that. So, oh yeah, attachment to the body. The Buddha was teaching to the monastics, the monks, the defects of the female body. It could work exactly the same for a woman looking at the defects of a man. If you take off the skin of a person, you would not be as attractive. They would not appear as attractive to you as they do when they have nice skin. The man is shaved or the woman has got her makeup on or perfume or whatever. If you look into the body to investigate the phlegm, the mucus, the excrement, the sweat, the blood, there's nothing attractive there. If you look at the parts, in the same way, if you look at the parts of the other person's mind, there's some things that might be attractive. They say sweet words to you out of their attachment to you sometimes, but then there are parts of their mind, they get angry, they're kind of obsessive, or they're, you know, I don't know, whatever, neurotic or whatever. And you recognize that there are parts there also that are unattractive. So that would be called appropriate attention, even though that sounds like, oh gosh, I don't, you don't have to engage in that all the time. But in order to subdue attachment, you can, you know, meditate on, you know, the parts of the other person or the parts of the situation, that some of which are good and some of which are bad. You get a new computer, you know, you're so transfixed with it, all the good parts, but then you have to remember when the warranty runs out, or if there's a software glitch or something like this, there are elements there that can put your mind in more in perspective. So you're not no longer, you can still enjoy your computer, but you're no longer attached to it the same way, because you see it with appropriate investigation, appropriate intention, attention. Usually when people say, I love you in the world, what does it mean? I love you. Nico, what is it? What is, when someone says, I love you, I don't know if you ever say that to people. What does that mean? Nico Knight. Nico Kite, I guess it is.
Yeah, Kite. Maybe that they love their attachment towards you, maybe?
Yeah, something to investigate. So I'm going to be, Donna's probably going to cut me off in a minute or two here because there's something coming on after this, right, Donna?
Go ahead, Venerable George, if you need the time.
I'll try to finish this train of thought. When we say, I love you, sometimes it means you please me. You know, there is, so that's sort of a code word for I love you. Real love is the wish for the other person to be happy from a Buddhist point of view, and from, I think, Christian point of view also, other religions. Real love means wanting the other person to be happy. Whereas we use it in the world when someone makes us happy. So we say, I love you, that kind of, in the same way that I love peanut butter, or I love chocolate. You know, it pleases me. You please me. And I say that, you know, we say that to others sometimes because with the anticipation that if they also find me pleasing for them, then we can get together and please each other. Whereas real love, a relationship that's based on real love, wanting the other person to be happy, is one that will remain longer, you know, a loving relationship. If your relationship is based on this superficial meaning of love, that you make me happy, when you no longer make me happy, then we say, I don't love you anymore. That's kind of strange, you know, from a spiritual point of view. If you had real love with the other person, even if they have faults, if they've developed, you know, abusiveness or so forth, you still want them to be happy, but you might recognize that the relationship is no longer tenable, but you still love the other person. To say, I don't love you anymore, that's kind of against the idea of Buddhist, what a Buddhist means by love. Love is definitely possible. Relationships can be based on love. In fact, you can make your relationships more durable if the more that you can subdue your attachment, your anticipation that the other person is going to please you, the more that that's present, the more attachment is present, the more that contaminates our loving relationships. You know, so those relationships that are durable, when one person experiences some suffering and they're not as pleasant to be with, or if they have an illness and they need more care, we think, I don't love you any longer because you're no longer able to cook the food or embrace me or, you know, so forth. That is a result of the defect of attachment and so forth. Attachments, so between anger and attachment, anger can be overcome quickly because the object of anger is something unpleasant, whereas attachment is more enduring. It lasts many, many lifetimes. It doesn't create such strong suffering immediately as anger does, but it lasts a long, long period of time. So I don't know what is happening now, but I remember Donna mentioning that there's something else that's going to happen about now. So I want to thank you for your attention last Sunday, today, and hoping that we'll see each other in the future. And let's end with a short dedication. So we've created some virtuous karma this morning. I mentioned at the beginning, we try to set a very special virtuous motivation. So we've created some virtuous karma this morning, maybe more karma, more virtuous karma that many people create in their entire life. Can you believe? With a bodhicitta motivation, that incredibly lofty thought to achieve enlightenment for the sake of other sentient beings. So at the end of any kind of practice, it's important to dedicate the merit that we've created. Dedication is a mental action where you think very strongly, wish very strongly that the karma ripen in a way that you would like to dictate. Just like when you have a certain amount of money and you dedicate it to a certain cause. So you say, it should go for this. This can have an effect on the ripening of our karma. to think, due to the virtues that I've created today, even the virtues I've created in the past, the present, and the future, may, in whatever way that ripens, a virtuous karma, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual development from life to life, day by day, year by year, life by life. May it become the cause of my developing a deep understanding of renunciation so that I'm not so attached to the appearances of this life. May it become the cause of my developing compassion and empathy for others, culminating in the thought to achieve enlightenment for their benefit. May it become the cause of my development of wisdom, insight, understanding selflessness and emptiness. Due to these merits, may I eventually become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings, where I can effortlessly and spontaneously, without error, lead them out of suffering into true everlasting happiness of Buddhahood, of omniscience. Make a firm decision, you know, wish that this, all this work that we've put in, listening with motivation and so forth, that its end result will be the betterment of all living beings by my achieving enlightenment, bringing about the happiness of all sentient beings. That's it. Yeah. So thank you very much for your attention. I'll leave it over to Donna. I'll be leaving. I assume you want people to stay, Donna, or is it a different event completely that has to start?
It's just different, yeah.
Okay. So I hope to see you again. I will teach again on Wednesday for Kadampa Center, if you have a chance to come. And see you. Take care.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Thank you, Venerable George.